Welcome to you to the Commonwealth Club today. I'm Gloria Duffy, the president and CEO of the club. You're accustomed to club programs, of course. Many of you are members of the club. I don't think we've ever had a club program about the club. The club always has programs about other topics. So today may well be a first in the history of the Commonwealth Club. You know very well what the club is and does. We have 450 programs a year, ranging from small conversations to debates to large addresses by public figures. We have some studies. We have some special projects like our Climate One project. We have a magazine. We have podcasts. We have radio broadcasts. Lots of activity going on at the Commonwealth Club. For the past 25 years or so, that has taken place here in this space. The club has been in different locations over its 111 years, always in the downtown area, always rented. And in this space, our rent has been going up in recent years. The club pays close to $600,000 in rent for this space. That includes our program space, of course, which means that unlike most nonprofits, we don't just have office space. We have large meeting spaces here at the club. But still, that's an awful lot for a nonprofit that relies mainly on donations, but membership dues, and some program revenue for its income every year. So we are anticipating moving, building a new building, restoring, renovating partially a building that exists down on the Embarcadero. You've been following this, I'm sure, in our magazine and other places. About 90% of all the club activities will then be able to take place in that building. A few larger events will still be out at the Castro Theater, as we had one last night, or other large meeting places. But about 90% of our activities will take place there. The new building will include auditoriums, informal meeting spaces, reception areas, AV production areas, and really accommodate all of our different activities. We've prepared a presentation for you today for your information and also to get your input. We've asked the various project personnel who are involved, ranging from our architect to our structural engineer and our sound and audio consultants for the project to be here with us. We're going to keep it informal today. I believe there is a mic here. We were able to pass the mic around for questions. We'll spend about half of the next hour on presentations by all the various personnel involved in the project, and then we'll take the other half for questions. No written question cards today. Feel free. We are recording it so that we can disseminate this more widely, so please do wait for the mic or speak into the mic so that we catch what you say on the recording. As we go through our presentation today, I believe you'll see not only a quest for economy by the Commonwealth Club in procuring this new space, but many of the values of the club reflected. Our founders, 111 years ago, wanted to create what they called an agora, which in Greek means a central square, a central place of education and debate and dialogue. So far, we've only been in temporary agoras in other people's space. This will truly be what we're calling a home for ideas and the agora for San Francisco and the Bay Area that our founders envisioned. So you'll find it reflects the desire to create a place for civic dialogue. And also, it reflects the club's long-held values for environmental sustainability. Let me introduce to you our panelists. First, we will have Piper Kujak. Piper is on staff at the club. We hired her to manage this project through the life of the acquisition of the building, the design, and the construction for the project. So she's called the club rep and building project manager. After she speaks, we'll hear from Marcia Matem and Greg Novikoff from Letty Matem Stacy Architects, who are our architects on the building project. Then we'll hear from Mark Steyer, Tipping Structural Engineers. Then we'll hear from Alistair McGregor, Arup Mechanical Engineering. And finally, we'll hear from Lloyd Randola and Alex Salter, Charles Salter Associates, who are acoustic, audio, and visual consultants for the building. So we have some slides here. Let me turn it over to Piper to start us off, and then we're going to go right down the line, and you'll hear a little bit from me towards the end. Thank you, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Gloria. Hello, everyone. So when the building was purchased by the club 2 years ago, I came on staff to manage this project. And today I'm going to talk about the first things we saw and what we've done with the project in the last couple years and give an overview of the site conditions. Here's an aerial view, and you can see the red dot at the end of Mission along the Embarcadero. That's our site. The site is bordered by Mission, Howard, and then faces Stewart and the Embarcadero. It's a very long slot site. It's 45 feet wide and 137 feet long. This is a simplified timeline of the urban history of the site. It was leveled after the 1906 earthquake and fire, and then the building that stands today was built in 1910. It was used for winemaking in the 20s, and then the most notable tenant was the International Longshoremen's Association in the early 30s. And in the early 30s, they planned the famed labor strikes, and the historic events of Bloody Thursday in 1934 took place on the street, in front of the building on Stewart Street. Fast forwarding a half century, in the 80s, a savings and loan occupied the building, and then it was used as a construction staging ground for the Hotel Vitale. And today it sits vacant, waiting for its new life. These are the two existing facades facing Embarcadero on the left and Stewart Street on the right. And inside the building, it's an empty, gutted shell, as it has been for much of the last couple decades. And the ground-level facades on facing both streets have also been gutted, so there's really nothing behind those construction covers you see on site. Upstairs, the original openings remain, but the windows have been modernized, and you can see there isn't any historic detail inside the building. These are four very different images of the site. You can see the historic Otterford building on the corner, and then our building next door, and then the Jewish Community Federation on the other side. The image in the lower left is of our basement. Those are the existing piers that we'll be reusing and got a dirt floor. The upper left is the existing roof between the Otterford and Jewish Community Federation. You can see that we're quite a bit smaller, lower than both the other buildings. And then in the upper right, that's our gorgeous view that we'll have in the new building. You're probably all wondering how our new building compares to the existing location. Here at 595 Market, we're on primarily one level, 11,000 square feet. As you probably know, the Blue Room seats 250 people, and the room we're in now holds up to 80. And you probably all know that we're short on bathrooms in the current location. And the new space will be 24,000 square feet over three main floors with a basement for storage and a roof terrace and garden above. And then the most frequently asked question I get is, how many bathrooms will we have in the new building? We'll have 16 on the three floors. And I should probably mention that we'll actually have an interim move between where we are now and the new space. This presentation isn't about that, but we'll get to that later, and you'll be hearing about that in the next month. This is a breakdown of the space allocation in the new building. About 50% will be dedicated to assembly, 30% for vertical circulation and services and all those bathrooms, and 20% for staff. And one of the first things we noticed walking the site and existing building are the large Doug fir heavy timbers. And so it's become a pet project for us, all of the design team to reuse those in the new building, and the designers will talk more about that. And the last point I want to make is all our work with city officials and planners and our wonderful design consultants over the last 2 years, it's been a constant, diligent effort. We've had many iterations of the design, and now Marcia and Greg of Lighting Medium Stacy will walk through that proposed design.
Thanks, Piper. And thank you for coming this afternoon to learn more about the project. And Greg and I are going to walk you through some of the basic planning and arrangement of the new club. And today you're going to get an interesting insider's view into the process, which people don't often get, and get more detail about the structure and the mechanical systems and the audiovisual. So it's kind of an interesting view that you're going to have. So that's who we are. As Piper mentioned, the site is really an interesting through-block lot, and it really will provide an incredible civic presence for the club along the waterfront edge. It's located near the regional transit hub, which is going to be very important and ideal for the club membership both within the city but also the regional members, so it's ideally situated. As Piper mentioned, the existing two-story building is in need of a lot of love, and we have worked really diligently with all the constituents of the club and the city and the planning department to come up with a very efficient plan, but we are adding a third floor to accommodate the club's program. But it's important to note that this is still well below the allowable height limit. So we have analyzed the existing building and the adjacent structures, and as well as the neighborhood context, and our Embarcadero facade responds to the proportion and rhythm of the existing structure, and the new facade is going to be divided into five bays that reflect the existing historic arrangement of the building on both of the facades. And we are going to have a defined bottom, base, middle, and top as in keeping with the planning department guidelines. So this building section, I think, is a good way to get you into the arrangement of the spaces in the flow. So this is a cross-section through the building. The Embarcadero Street is on the right-hand side of the slide, and the Stewart Street is on the left-hand side of the slide, just to get you oriented. And the you can see the basement level at the bottom. There, oop, doesn't show up on this. Oh well. On the first floor, we have the Embarcadero. Excuse me.
It does show up.
Oh, it does. I'm sorry.
They want the laser.
No, not on the TV.
Not on the TV.
The laser that's not showing up.
Yeah, I'm sorry. So on the main level, on the public entry lobby on the Embarcadero side. On the first floor, we also have a flexible meeting space that can be divided into two different smaller meeting spaces. On level two is the maid auditorium. You can see towards the left-hand side of the second level. And that, as Piper mentioned, is sized to accommodate approximately 300 people. And it has a high volume, which is required for the functionality of the space. So you can see that that's a much higher ceiling height on that second level. Facing the Embarcadero is the pre-function space. Again, a nice high lofty volume with that fantastic view to the bay and along the waterfront. And that, again, is sized large enough to accommodate the flow both before and after presentations and to have space for breakout and smaller meeting groups. On the third floor, facing the Embarcadero side, is an additional meeting room and small pre-function space. And then on the right-hand side of the third floor are the offices. And then on the top is a fantastic roof terrace and a small roof garden. So that's the basic layout. And so now Greg Novikoff is going to walk you through a little bit more detail.
So these are the plans. And so I know understanding building sections can be a little bit difficult, and to orient you to the building plan, we're going to talk about the bottom slide, bottom image first. That's the first floor. And on the right is the Embarcadero, all the way to the right, and all the way to the left is Stewart Street to orient you. The main entry is on Embarcadero, and that's a unique feature for that block. Many of the entries are on Stewart Street, so this will be really activating that block between Mission and going south to San Francisco. In that Embarcadero entry, you'll be greeted with the main stair, and the, right behind that are the bathrooms and the elevators. And all the way to the back are those two meeting rooms that will have windows onto Stewart Street. And right in the heart of that space on the first floor will be the new library, kind of activating the center of space. There are lots of small informal meeting areas on that first floor. In the lobby is the main stair going up, and you'll see that in a moment in a rendering. And above that is the pre-function space. That's the brown area on the top right there. You pass through a little vestibule, and then you come to the 300-seat auditorium in the back there. And you can imagine that that whole auditorium, all 300 people, really need to have a breakout space, and they go to that pre-function space with the amazing view of the bay. Going up, the elevators on the bottom here on the third floor, the elevators take you to a small reception area, and to on the right would be another pre-function space and a small meeting area overlooking the bay. And if you make the left-hand turn from the elevators, you come to the office space for the Commonwealth Club. And then all the way to the far back, to the far left, is a small little deck for the Commonwealth Club offices that has that setback from Stewart Street that you saw earlier in the renderings that sets back about between 7 and 11 feet. Going all the way up to the top, to the deck on the fourth on the rooftop, you can see the big open space of hardscape and plaza area that overlooks the bay, and behind that, the garden. So just to backtrack to the renderings, this is the first view that you get right when you come into the front door. You're greeted with, and we'll hear more from our consultants, but you'll be greeted with digital media, with places to sit. Off to your left is the queuing area and the reception for checking in. And then back there is the entryway to the library and to the meeting rooms beyond. But this is the main stair that takes you up to the pre-function and the auditorium above. And here we are in the auditorium. This is that main meeting space for 300 people. It has the reclaimed wood that you heard about a little bit. And it's not just reclaimed wood. It's really doing a couple of things. The reclaimed wood is also our acoustic kind of surface material that creates baffling for really the premier acoustics that the space needs to have. It has integrated audio-visual that you'll hear about a little bit. But it's also a really flexible space. You know, we wanted to give the Commonwealth Club more than just one space. The space could be formatted in the kind of presentation format. It could be formatted in all the different ways, either meetings in the round, informal smaller meetings, or kind of seating and dining configurations. So we're really excited about how flexible the space can be used. And then coming out of that space is the pre-function space with that spectacular view of the bay, again with casual seating and digital media to really kind of connect what's going on in the auditorium with what's happening in that pre-function space. So with that, we're going to talk a little bit more about the history.
So Gloria will give you a little bit more information on how we're going to commemorate the important history that happened. But the Stewart Street site, as Piper mentioned, was the site of the strikes and the activities on Bloody Thursday. And so the Stewart Street site is has been deemed the historic side of the building, and the club will honor that in how we're treating it. This shows that setback that Greg pointed out in the plan, that the new third floor is pulled far back from that historic facade, and we will be restoring that historic facade and repairing it. On the Embarcadero side, this historic photograph from the 50s is interesting to show just how this was really a working retail part of the waterfront, and that it's had an ongoing history of a variety of small retail spaces over the years, and that all of that is gone now. It's been all demolished on the first level, as well as the windows removed, the detailing at the top of the building, and of course the historic fire escape is gone. It's also important to note that we discovered that there was on the Sanborn map a dividing wall in the middle of the building that really established the address on Stewart Street versus the addresses on Embarcadero. So the building, as I mentioned, needs a lot of love, and it has been gutted over the last decade, and it has been sitting abandoned. So the time is right to take care of this resource and to bring it into the future and provide this great home for the Commonwealth Club. As you can see, it takes a lot of imagination to, when you walk through it now, to see what how wonderful it will be in the future. But in terms of the Embarcadero facade, I think that we worked very closely with the planning department and the historic preservation group at the city to come up with the facade, which, as I mentioned before, reflects the five-part division of the historic building, adds the third floor, and really provides a new civic presence for the club. And it also integrates a highly efficient and high-performance facade, which meets the environmental goals for the club. And just zooming in a little bit, that it is important to recognize what important leadership the Commonwealth Club does provide in environmental stewardship. And the club is very committed to having this design and this be a statement for their commitment to a low-carbon future and environmental performance. And that also makes great business sense, which Alistair will talk about in a few minutes. Some of the features that we have included on the Embarcadero facade are operable windows, which provide great health and quality of air, and we'll get a little bit more into the detail of that in a minute. But we are on target for LEED Gold and possibly LEED Platinum from the U.S. Green Building Council program. And we've incorporated 51 operable windows, high-performance glazing, recycling of building materials, as was discussed, and high-efficiency lighting and building systems throughout. So with that, we'll give you a little insight into the structure.
Thank you, Marcia. I'm Mark with Tipping Structural Engineers, and I'm going to talk about the structural design. So the main goal for us as the structural engineers is really to support the architectural space plan and the beautiful spaces that Marcia and Greg and the Commonwealth Club have envisioned for this new building. So to do that, we've provided here on the right, what you can see is not quite as pretty of a view as what you've seen so far, but this is really the skeleton of the new structure. So this is a mix of several different materials. We've got existing concrete and wood. We've got new steel and concrete. We've got existing new light gauge metal walls, and at the bottom what you see are those are existing piles, which are the existing foundation for the project. And so our goal is to really create a mix of materials to support the space. This is a cross-section through the building, and what you can see in orange are the parts of the structure that are new, and down at the basement you can see parts of the structure that are existing. Part of the challenge is to try and reuse the existing foundation without having to do a lot of expensive work to found this building on competent bedrock. The building sits on the bay mud, which is a very soft material, and so the existing piles are doing a great job of holding the building up. We actually studied this building about 10 years ago and did some testing to determine the capacity of these piles, and we used that data to figure out exactly how much new structural weight we can put on the structure. And so a lot of our design was involved in trying to put the weight of the new vertical floors in exactly the right place so that we can reuse the existing piles. Part of that design involves, at the second floor, using some of the interior piles, but at the floors above, clear spanning across the space to not only create the open area for the auditorium, but to put all the weight of the new structure down on the existing side walls. The reason that we can do that is that we're cutting off about 15 feet of the existing concrete walls on the sides and replacing it with a lighter weight material, which then allows us to put the new floors on. Another part of our design, of course, being in San Francisco, is to make sure that this building will be earthquake safe and will perform very well. There's a high likelihood of an earthquake here in the city, so we take that into account every day in our work. What we are primarily relying upon are new concrete shear walls. These concrete shear walls will be vertically post-tensioned, and by putting this vertical post-tensioning in conjunction with conventional reinforcing, we provide a strong and robust system that not only will flex and dissipate energy in an earthquake, but has a sort of elastic band effect in the middle that can help bring the building back to plumb after an earthquake. So this is a cross-section through the building showing our new shear wall on the right, supporting some of the framing above. And this is a technology that we've been using for about 10 years in various projects in the Bay Area to get the benefits of both restoring a building to squareness and providing it tough enough resistance. In addition to the structural design, we try to really keep with the project goals for sustainability, which Marcia and Gloria have already talked about as an important focus. And so as a structural engineer, what we can focus on is concrete, which has actually a very large impact in the embodied carbon of the structure. We pay close attention to the amount of cement that we specify in our concrete mixes, and we use blast furnace slag to replace some of the cement that would otherwise be used in the concrete mix and minimize the carbon footprint of the concrete. By doing that, we pay close attention to the specifications. So we don't take a typical mix and just add slag to it and say that it's now using half recycled material and we've replaced 50% of the carbon. What we do is we actually work closely with the concrete mix designers to come up with the minimum amount of cement that can be in the mix and then use additional slag appropriately to get up to the strength that we need. So we really target about a 50% reduction in embodied carbon in our concrete mixes. And so that's my part. Now, Alistair.
Do I need to speak into the mic for everyone to hear or to record?
For the recording to hear it.
Okay.
Everyone else can hear it.
I'll use that then.
Okay. I'm a mechanical engineer, and I spent most of the time on this project trying to take mechanical systems out of the building, which might be kind of bizarre. So why did we want to use natural ventilation where we could in this building? There's three main reasons. The first is we can reduce our energy footprint by doing that, reduce the carbon footprint. The second thing is by putting less systems into the building, we actually reduce our costs, and we can put the money into the air conditioning systems that go into the auditorium spaces, and that's where we really want the high quality. But I think probably the biggest reason is that people actually like it. And this is surveys from the Center for Built Environment at Cal. These orange triangles are naturally ventilated buildings and occupant satisfaction with them, and they're skewed over to the right. In other words, buildings with windows and natural ventilation score much higher than air-conditioned buildings in occupant satisfaction. The spaces we're doing are the pre-function, the lobby, and the open office area at the top. And then, of course, these areas are air-conditioned. So that's the theory. Putting it into practice, you have to think of a lot of other things. One of the issues we deal with is how much control do we give to the occupants? Can we allow them just to open windows willy-nilly? Can we have a backup system? And what we do is we do a mix of both. So here are operable windows that you can open if you decide it's a little bit warm in the pre-function area. But then we have a control system with the other windows that are on automatic control. So you can never get too far out. And then we have to deal with issues like acoustics, where we've got a busy street on Embarcadero. How do we stop the noise coming in? And what we ended up was a design like this. This is the entrance to the building. This is the pre-function area. The air comes in through here. It comes through an acoustically baffled bend and up into the space. So we not only by doing this, we reduce the risk of dust coming in. We take the noise out, and in winter, there's a heating element here so that the cold air that comes in is actually heated before it comes into the space. Similar deal for the lobby area. And then up at the office space, we come in off the outdoor seating space, again through a heater, through an acoustic baffle, so that you can have natural ventilation without the problems of acoustics coming through.
I'm Alex Salter with Charles Salter Associates. We did the acoustical and AV on the project. The main showcase of the Commonwealth Club is going to be the auditorium. People come to the Commonwealth Club to hear prominent people speak, and it provides a forum for people to share and gain knowledge. And so if you can't understand that person, then that is hampered a lot. So we focused a lot on the auditorium as well as other spaces, but one of the main features of this auditorium, as was discussed before by Greg, is the acoustic wood, reclaimed wood. And we looked at that and really looked at the sizing of these wood members, the spacing between them, and we have acoustic insulation behind it as well. And so this is a really tuned room to give optimal acoustics for the events that the Commonwealth Club is going to want to have here. We also paid attention to other spaces and the effect it would have on the auditorium. So, for example, sound isolation. We don't want activity from the pre-function areas to bother events going on in the auditorium. So we've taken that into account. Also, background noise levels. If we have a noisy HVAC system, that's going to make it very hard for people to understand people talking. So we've worked with AirUp to quiet down the little HVAC that we do have in this building. Other areas we've looked at is on the first floor, the ground floor meeting rooms, improving the acoustics in those spaces, as well as reducing reverberation in the lobby and pre-function spaces. And Lloyd will talk about the AV systems we've included.
Hello, I'm Lloyd. I work with Alex at Charles Salter. I primarily focused on the audiovisual systems throughout the space. Again, the showcase being the auditorium. Obviously, a large difference here will be the large projection screen as being different from the existing space. We have a sound system that's permanently installed and tuned specifically for speech intelligibility, not necessarily a music venue type sound system, but that allows us to create these really sleek column array speakers, which we use in places that require heavy speech reinforcement. The angled ceiling right there tucks in a lot of our other devices, such as spotlights, primarily hidden through there, so we don't have too many things hanging. And throughout the space, we have various places for cabling, really, so we're minimizing the amount of cabling that goes front to back, and the cameras have a nice place to plug in towards the back of the room. The sound system has a nice place in the back of the room to work with. There's a new AV control center here where they can actually monitor everything and produce media for online and other distribution. The entire building is wired for distribution, so the idea being we can send anything to anywhere. The auditorium, for example, can overflow into the various displays. There are displays flanking pre-function, both sides of the lobby, and then one display in the library as well. So we could have constantly running digital content if we like, or we could do overflow from various spaces within the facility. In the roof, in the third floor, really, we've just upgraded all of the cabling. We wanted to make this a modern facility, good Wi-Fi for everybody here and everybody working, and some connectivity up at the roof deck as well for any other presentations or background music or anything that we need to plug in up there.
Thank you all, and I will take that. Thanks. Let's see here. There we go. So this building is considered historic, not because of the architecture or the architect, but because of events that are associated with the building. In 1934, the dock workers along the docks in San Francisco struck for a number of reasons. They were seeking better hours, better pay, hiring halls that weren't controlled by the shipping companies, the shipping companies could then just pick and choose who they wanted to work for the day, where there was more equal access to the work that was available. It was the Depression, people were out of work, people were hungry, so this kind of equitable access to work was a very big issue. In the spring of 1934, going on into the summer, the Longshoremen's Union were joined, there was a general strike called in sympathy with the Longshoremen's Union, which for several days paralyzed everything in San Francisco, and also there was a dock strike up and down the Pacific Coast. On July 5th of 1934, And remember, the Longshoremen's Union Hall was in our building on the second floor entered from Stewart Street. And it was the site where Harry Bridges, the leader who formed the union, did the organizing of these strikes. There was a clash outside the building at Mission and Stewart Streets, and the police killed two of the, actually one striker and one cook in the strike cafeteria. They laid in state in our building, and their funeral cortege a few days later, to which thousands of people attended, started from this building and moved down Market Street. Out of all of this came some congressional action the next year, the Wagner Act, which established the right of unions for collective bargaining. It also established the National Labor Relations Board. Some of major reforms in labor history for the United States were precipitated by these events. The July 5th was called Bloody Thursday due to the killings of workers. And this year is actually the 80th anniversary of Bloody Thursday. So what the club is doing a great deal to mark and commemorate this history. We're focused on the Stewart Street side of the building for a variety of reasons, but that's where you entered the Longshoremen's Union, that's where their address was, and that's where these tragedies took place. We are, as Marcia mentioned, restoring the Stewart Street facade to more or less the way it looked in 1934, which will be an educational tool about what happened there. We're placing a plaque about the history next to the entrance on Stewart Street. There'll be two entrances to the club, one on the Embarcadero and one on Stewart Street. We are producing, we're just getting going with this project, digital content of photographs, video, audio, documents about Bloody Thursday and the events that occurred that will be on a dedicated screen inside the main lobby of the Commonwealth Club off of the Embarcadero. We can use digital content because we can constantly refresh it as new information, new history, new documents are coming to light. We are very fortunate to be working with the leadership of the ILWU, which is the inheritor of the ILA. It's the current version of the Longshoremen's Union. They have an archivist, they have a library, they have a historian who are extremely well-informed about these events. There's also been a PBS film about the events of Bloody Thursday. So we have a rich resource of material to work with here to commemorate the history. So we actually met earlier this week with the historian and the archivist. We're working on the text of the plaque with them and also the digital content for inside the building. Because this site is so important in the history of labor, not only here but in the West, Western U.S. and throughout the United States, we're also working with the Central Labor Council and the Building and Trades Building and Construction Trades Council to make sure that what we're doing accurately reflects the history. This is particularly interesting to me because my father was a stevedore on the docks in the late 1930s. As a teenager, he worked in San Francisco, and he also unloaded sugar over on the dock in Crockett. And so I have a particular interest in exploring this history. He's no longer living, but it's very interesting for me to work on this with the union folks. To make sure also that our building project is supported and that we get the input we need, we have met with dozens of folks, unions, SF Heritage, which is probably the principal historic preservation group in San Francisco, which is supporting our project, with historians, with all of the neighbors in the area, the Jewish Federation next door, the YMCA down the block, the restaurants, the hotels, and so on, with preservationists like the Victorian Alliance, with environmental groups to get the input. We started actually with PG&E, and then we've moved on to others with expertise on energy issues and various environmental groups concerned with climate change and so on to make sure that the design of our building has the lowest possible carbon footprint. We have broad support for our project. And in particular for the facade on the Embarcadero, we have had letters of support to the Planning Commission. I think we have had 25 letters of support from the YMCA, Jewish Federation, residents, businesses, restaurants, hotels, the owner of the Autofred building next door, and heads of environmental groups, and so on. One last comment about this, just to make sure that it's understood. The Commonwealth Club is putting a glass facade on the Embarcadero side for several reasons, in part because the original facade on the Embarcadero has been largely destroyed over the years, but because on the Embarcadero facade we have 51 operable windows, which allow us to cool primarily with bay air in combination with ceiling fans inside the building. That one feature of the building provides 2/3 of the LEED points for us to be LEED gold or LEED platinum, which is the compliance with being a low carbon footprint, energy efficient building. These are pictures of what is happening periodically on the Embarcadero. That is sea level rise, which is a consequence of global warming. This is the bay water overflowing the Embarcadero. So we strongly believe that it is the responsibility of every builder, whether a nonprofit or a commercial builder, to build a low carbon footprint building. Building carbon emissions are one of the largest components of global warming, and particularly located right here on the Embarcadero, where the sea level rise is something that is increasingly visible. We are committed to that, and we're committed to using our building to educate about the importance of doing that. So we thank you for listening, and thank all our panelists. And now we're open for questions, all field questions. Feel free to ask the individual panelists or direct them to me. And here we have a mic, and just raise your hand, and the mic can be brought to you.
Hi. Several things come to mind. I guess I'm looking at this, and I'm wondering, is the building going to be raised a little bit for sea level rise, or is that...
Well, can anyone talk about the basement? We are waterproofing the basement, I know that. Does anyone want to address that in particular?
We are waterproofing the basement, and we do have pumps in the basement should we need to get water out of the building to prevent that. We are building... Embarcadero on that side of the street is actually slightly elevated than the seawall side, so there is a slight benefit in cross slope to the Embarcadero as well. That's to our benefit.
As I understand it, this is an issue that's going to have to be dealt with for the city and for the community here. It's obviously not just a matter of a single building waterproofing itself, which we're going to do the best possible, but this is an issue that's going to be faced by every city that is fronting on ocean or bay water, and it's something down the road for the city of San Francisco to deal with for its entire waterfront.
We've also raised some of our electronics in the basement, just above the floor, so just kidding.
I had just one other question.
Could we actually move to somebody else, and then we'll come back to you if there's time. Thank you.
In the current old building, the escalator has been a very efficient way to bring people up, but more importantly, when the program's over, to take people down to the street. I noticed that you've replaced the escalator with elevators, and my experience in buildings with elevators is you spend a lot of time waiting for the elevator to come back up.
So the answer to this in broad terms is we do have two elevators. We also have a large staircase going from the first floor, and I'm trying to get back to the photo that will show you that, there is a large open staircase. So for those who are able-bodied and able to climb stairs, that's a way up to the auditorium level, and it will be a wide accessible, you know, staircase, then there are two elevators. But perhaps our experts have better answers. Where's the mic?
Excuse me. We do have the largest elevators possible. They're 4,000-pound elevators, and they are the fastest for this height. We're just a three-story or four-level building, so...
These folks have studied that, and we feel that we have capacity to move people. There are also two more staircases, fire staircases behind doors and so on. So, again, there are multiple ways to get up and down. How many people do the elevators hold?
I believe they're
25 each. So two elevators that hold 25 people. And going one floor, hopefully that will be able to move a significant number of people. But, again, good question. Yes, ma'am. Mike to this. Oh, I'm sorry. Gary? Excuse me. Gary was next.
Being a businessman and former developer, the thought came to me like, if you can build, what, eight stories there?
Six.
So you ran the numbers versus taking the building out and building the full six and renting out the top?
Yeah. So there,
didn't pencil out.
There are a couple of limitations here. One is the club has raised all of the funds for this project. The more height we would add, the more funds we'd have to raise. And to be very frank, we're only two-thirds of the way towards raising all the funds needed for the building. We're continuing to raise funds, and we may have a loan for the rest of the money. So the club has no endowment. It has no history of raising large amounts of money. So it has been somewhat of a struggle. It's taken us the last 3 years to raise two-thirds of the funds for this project. So that's one limitation. The other limitation is something that could be discussed by our structural engineers, which is the pilings that underpin the building. I think they neglected to mention that these are 100-year-old timbers that have been there since the building was built. So do you want to say anything about the load and weight capacity of those pilings?
Sure. Is this on? Yes. Yeah, as I mentioned, for the structural design of the current building, we've been very strategic in locating the weight of the two-story addition on top of the existing pilings. If we were to go to more stories, then it would involve adding new deep foundations, which involves pilings down to the bedrock 100-foot deep piles. So there's a significant jump in cost to make the structure any larger than it currently is if you're trying to reuse the existing foundations.
Also, with the controversy... With the controversies about height on the waterfront, the fact that we are a very low-rise building is a neighborly thing to do to those buildings around us as well. There will be no difficulty seeing out for some of the taller buildings, seeing out to the water from behind the club's building. Yes, ma'am.
Rhianne Ryan. I am part of the art panel for the Commonwealth Club. And I've heard rumors and seen a few sneak photos of possible gallery-type space for fine art, and I didn't hear that addressed in any of the presentation. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I don't know if there's a slide that shows this, but there will be lots of wall space. There will be a gallery walls coming in off the Stewart Street entrance on both sides, and many, many spaces throughout the building for artwork on the walls. We plan to have a half dozen digital screens, which will have one screen will be dedicated to what's upcoming at the club, what's going on at the club. Another will be dedicated to the history of the building. Another will be dedicated to perhaps a news quiz or some kind of interactive information based on what the programs and the topics. And whatever space is not covered by those digital screens will be available for hanging artwork. But there's a particular area, coming in from the Stewart Street side, which Greg will point out.
This is referred to as the gallery, this whole zone right here, as well as the elevator vestibules on all the floors are meant to be kind of gallery walls.
Another possibility we've talked about is up on the roof deck, which is, let's see if I can make this work. Nope. This top drawing there, we have a possibility of perhaps some sculpture, metal sculpture. So if this is not in our budget at the moment, but if anybody has ideas about that and knows how we would raise the funds or find the donations of sculpture, that's another possibility. We have part of the roof is a green roof. Part is a hardscape that will be available for receptions up there, but then around all around the edges is greenscape, and putting sculpture in some of that, some of those beds would be a great idea.
That's very generous. Thank you.
Sure. Well, as you see, we from the walls of this room, we love to have artists exhibit at the club. This gentleman?
I'm a frequent participant in the Commonwealth Club's book group, and most of the participants very much appreciate having an oval table. It usually meets in the boardroom, and an oval or a circular table would be pretty much ideal. People want to take notes. They want to reference books sometimes. Is there going to be any equivalent in the new building?
So let's see here. If you look at the, where are we here? There. So the bottom slide, that's the third floor. On the left-hand side is the staff office and seating area. On the right-hand side at the top is the boardroom with the table. We're not going to take the same table, but there will be an equivalent table there. And then a sort of reception area outside there. So that is your boardroom, and that is the, that'll be the smallest meeting room there. The club will also have furniture that we can move from place to place, tables, chairs, etc. That's why the basement level will be very helpful to store a lot of that. So we can also set up other rooms, say the library or the smaller meeting room actually divides in half into two smaller meeting rooms at the far left on the bottom side. And so we could put tables in there for particular meetings. But the regular space will be up on the third floor. There will be a boardroom. Let's take others, and then we'll get back to Gary. Yes, sir?
The club has been having tours of the area. Rick, I believe, is the tour guide. I was on that first tour they took when he was testing us all out and his own timing. It was very good. He did mention that there'd be a museum, if you will, of the labor thing. And I suspect that's the off of Stewart Street, and the place on your map was the lower left. The room's right there. And I presume it would also be always publicly open.
So, again, we're working with the union on that, the primary union that was involved in the history of this building. We're still in the discussion stage. What we know we're going to do is a plaque on the outside of the building on Stewart Street. Most of the people will enter the club, though, on the Embarcadero side, where there'll be larger doors. So our preliminary decision is to put a screen with educational, historical, informational material, like a film that will constantly run on this in the Embarcadero lobby, because that's where most people will come in. Even if they're not coming for programs, they will come in, they can come and look at that and so on. Whether it'll be open 24/7, I'm not sure, but it will certainly be open extended hours from the morning through the evening when the club is having programs and events. What we discussed earlier this week with the union representatives is whether we should have any physical items there, any union memorabilia. And so we're debating that. Where would we put it? How would we keep it secure? But that's all in discussion at the moment with the union. Yes, ma'am.
I had a quick thought when you were talking about the auditorium. An auditorium for 300 people is a pretty good size space. When I come here a lot I'm a San Franciscan, and I come here a lot to meetings. One thing I'm always aware of, I'm 5'4". I can hardly ever see what's going on. And it just struck me that in a room with 300 people, it's going to be worse, because I know some of the things that we have at other programs are huge. I'm just thinking, off the top of my head, I'm just thinking, did anyone ever think of maybe a room that slopes down a little bit? Maybe a room that has tall chairs in the back, short, something, but because it really, the experience really matters.
We did think about that. We talked about all kinds of things, having it like a step-down auditorium. We taught, our architects will know the right terms for these. We talked even about mobile bleacher seating or seating that collapses back into cupboards on the walls and so on. In the end, we decided to go with flat surface and no fixed seating because it makes the room usable for so many different types of activities. So there can be tables and chairs. There can be round discussions in the round. There can be, it can face this way, it can face that way, depending on the number of seats and so on. So we decided to make it as flexible as possible. However, that's a very good question, and I'll put it to any of our experts here as to how one would do that, given that we will have a flat design.
Lloyd? We also have room for risers, so if we did want to bring us up front up for you to see better, we can do that. But the AV system helps. We often do what's called image magnification, and rather than just being content on the screen, if it's just a sole speaker, we could certainly put a close-up or a zoomed-in picture of the presenter up on the large screen. That usually helps a lot for the larger venues.
So if you have ideas, again, the club spaces get a huge amount of use. They're in use pretty much all the time. We outside groups use them sometimes. We use them for our programs. So keeping it flexible was a high priority. But if you have ideas about how to equip this in a way that would allow for better sight lines to the speaker, we'd be delighted. Let me also say, by the way, there will be full handicapped access for this building, including the stage, for speakers that are in a wheelchair or otherwise disabled. So that is part of the design. Yes, ma'am.
Would temporary staging work for that?
Possibly. We could raise up a stage higher.
Yes.
Yeah, I think there are a variety of things we can do as sort of aftermarket solutions to this. Once the space is already built, then we can bring in various aids to help with sight and audio and access. Gary.
Can you put the auditorium up, please?
That's it.
No, I mean the plant.
Okay.
Where the elevators are.
Okay, let's see here. Okay, elevators are the white area down at, no?
No, I mean,
I'm sorry.
One, that's it.
Okay, white area is at the bottom there.
My intuition tells me that I don't know how wide your ingress and egress area is, but if you have 300 people in that auditorium and your elevators are where they're located, I think you're going to have mass congestion in a large program.
Actually, we have some very large spaces. So this is where you come up the stairs on the left to the second floor, and then just past where you can see would be where the elevators are. It's actually a pretty big causeway that goes through to the big auditorium, which is back this way. I don't know how to best show that. It's a good concern, but I'm assuming our folks here have designed with that in mind.
The reason I'm addressing this is when you exit in this building, people always linger and chat. And if that's a narrow opening, and if they're standing in front of that elevator and people want to get out, I don't think they're going to make it. And I do agree with this man that escalators would probably be a better solution for ingress and egress compared to elevators.
So let me just, how wide is the ingress and egress from the big auditorium? It's that first
it looks like
tan
10 feet
patch.
To me. Is that about 10 feet?
I think it's about 12 feet.
That's not a lot. You've got then, 300 people coming through there.
And then you move on through, and there's that large holding area out on against the Embarcadero, the large tan area.
This is why I'm addressing this. You can't get to that area without going through the crowds that are waiting to get in the elevator. That's a major issue because you're going to live with this building. And I would seriously think about either widening that or changing to escalators because you cannot get to the Embarcadero.
Let's, Marcia, our architect.
The site, although it's an incredible site, there are some interesting challenges because of the width of the building and because of the efficiency that we've been trying to achieve for the club in order to get as much program space as possible but still bring everything else that is required into the building. So we understand and we agree with you that it's been really challenging to meet the programmatic needs as well as the fire code needs and the other exiting requirements that are code required. And so escalators have another set of issues with them in terms of exiting and fire department requirements. And of course, yes, there are costs. But we feel that there are three stairs that are on this floor. The two in the white, Greg, you might want to point them out just to be clear. So I think there's a number of ways that the club will be able to manage the flow of people.
See, everything
people.
You're pointing to, you have to go through that little lobby, and that's my
no,
point.
No, the one is on
there's
the other side
at the back.
Of the auditorium.
There's a stair at the back that goes directly out to Stewart Street. So it's much like a main theater at the Castro or at the Kabuki, where there are different areas that if the crowd is very large, the management can adjust how the flow of people occurs at the end of the event. So I think that there are some different options for managing effectively the flow of people through the building. But you're right that it is something that we did spend a large amount of time thinking about, balancing all the various needs, both programmatically and code-wise, and efficiency-wise to get the most flexible space.
This has been hard work, and it was hard work to find a location because our criteria are to be in the Market Street corridor. We polled our members, and the majority reached the club by public transit or walking. And so being near BART, Muni, et cetera, restricted us to a pretty narrow area. And then we were able to find this building in a lovely location, but it is extremely narrow. So fitting public meeting space into a building that is this narrow was quite a design challenge. And so we had to make trade-offs. For instance, where we are here, the club's meeting spaces and reception areas and flow is all on one level. Here it's on three levels. We had to, on the Embarcadero side of the building, we had to stack it up, basically. The reception areas and library and so on. So there were challenges and there were trade-offs. We feel this will work, but again, everything, we had hoped to have a kitchen, a full kitchen. We don't have room for that. We're squeezing 40-some staff into a relatively small area of open office seating. So there were compromises to be made all over the building. And it's a challenge, but worth it for this particular location, we feel.
Lobby is a compressed space. I think it's important to note that it's not enclosed. It's fully open and connected to, on the ground level, of course, the lobby, then the pre-function space, and even on the third floor, it's open to almost a mirror of the conference room. And by the way, the conference room does open up into that level on the third floor, so that's a whole other assembly space. I also wanted to point out that while there is room to flow through, no one's going to feel trapped. It may be that the club puts up the snakes and has people in one line to get to elevators and then moving on through to the pre-function for the others. And what I've seen with the club is that they make it work in a lot of challenging spaces.
But again, Gary, thanks. Good thought.
If you're in a hurry, you've got
Well, the elevators all have to stack up in one location. Sure. Okay, well, happy to talk with you about it further. Now, we are at our time limit here, but happy to go on a little bit longer if anybody wants to stay. And let's, this lady, and then you, sir.
Let's talk about the interim move.
Sure.
Can you do that?
People like to hear about that. So the club had hoped to begin construction on its building this past summer. We had our groundbreaking in July, which some of you may have attended. We have had two hearings at the Planning Commission. We've had someone appeal this. We've had 7-0 votes at both hearings in favor because there is such broad support for the club's project. But this is a process that's taking some time and costing the club, of course, quite a bit. One of the outcomes of this is our lease here ends in a few months, so we're going to have to move to temporary space until we finish the city approvals process and can get going on the construction. Construction will be about 14 months. So allowing a few more months to get through the city approvals process, we're looking at least 18 months before we can have this building ready and be in it. So we are in negotiations right now for a space at 111 Maiden Lane. That is just off of Union Square. It is the entire floor of a building. It's beautiful space. It's, I guess, the third floor up. There are two elevators, and some stairways. And, again, it's not ideal. It's hard to find, this is 12,000 square feet, that has configurations that will work for meetings in it. We'll have to do a little bit of tenant improvements on it to make that happen. But it's hard to find that kind of space in the downtown area that's easily accessible to BART and so on. So we haven't signed a lease yet. We're negotiating it right now. Our move would come probably fairly shortly after the first of the year. We're gearing up for lots of information to be sent out to our members and the community about where we will be, probably in the January, February timeframe. So stay tuned. This is all going to be completed in the next few days. This is the cost of the process we're going through with an appellant, with incurring the extra rent at an interim space instead of being able to go into the new space more quickly. Let's go to folks who haven't asked a question first. Sir, did you ask your question? Okay, there you go. Other questions or comments? And again, you're welcome to stay afterwards and talk with the team who's here. Other questions, other comments? Okay, sir, one more, and then we'll close it off.
Listening to the discussion about the traffic flow, it seems to me perhaps just changing the colors of the carpet to reflect ingress to the elevators, things like that, in conversation areas might be one solution.
Good thought.
The second thing is the lady who is 5'4" and talking about sight lines. I'm the guy that she doesn't want to sit behind at 6'6". And I make a point to sit over towards the side always. I'm one in because just availability of seats today.
That's
but
very
perhaps
courteous.
Perhaps there might be a tradition established on simply the taller people sitting towards the sides.
That is
and
a very good
if
idea.
It opened, if it began at that particular point, it would be a continuity
sort of
thing.
That's a very nice idea. And I would say if the club were to start that, maybe movie theaters would pick that up and symphony halls and others. Since we all have this experience, I mean, I'm not short, but I'm not tall. So, in any case, thanks so much to all of our design team. Thanks to you for coming and listening and giving us feedback. Did I mention that Rick Evans, who is conducting our tours of the waterfront, is sitting right here? He's done 3 tours so far. He has 3 more scheduled. And see him if you're interested, but we are educating the public more broadly about the waterfront area and the project. Thank you so much, and keep following this. We'll keep you informed about what's going on. Thank you.